When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. But you thought this was a House of the Dragon podcast, didn't you? No, we're still wrapping up book one of Game of Thrones. This week we are talking about the second to the last chapter of the entire book. This is Catelyn's final POV chapter in this book. And here to help me with this chapter is medievalist Brian Pavlak. Brian has taught all over the world, Rome, Austria, Germany. Check out his book, Game of Thrones versus History, Written in Blood. What a great resource if you're interested in the real life analogs to some of the characters that we meet in Martin's world. Then after Brian, Trip Fuller's back to talk about some recent happenings in the world of fantasy literature. Big week over at Double Dragon. Steve and I complete our journey we began almost 2 years ago as Steve does his first watch of the Iron Throne. That's right, the final nosedive into disappointment and regret. Find out why Steve loves this episode. That's right. Do a search for Double Dragon. You'll hear Steve defend the inexplicable desires of his heart. Okay, without further ado, here is Professor Brian Pavlak. Brian, let's go ahead and jump into this chapter. Mm-hmm. This is Kat's final point of view chapter.
Is it? She doesn't have a point of view in the next volume?
Oh, sorry. Of course she does.
Okay. Because, you know, it's the second to last chapter in the entire book. So.
Right. So, yeah, so we're dealing with Kat's final chapter in this first book, and I'll just go ahead and read my synopsis, and then we can kind of jump in. All right, so Catelyn crosses the river to boat under the walls of Riverrun. She's greeted by her brother, Edmure. She's taken to her dying father, Lord Hoster Tully, who asks after his children and grandchildren, and is disappointed that Lysa did not come. Kat finds Rob praying with his men in the Godswood. Afterward, the lords and warriors meet in the great hall of House Tully and argue over war and peace and kings and rights to rule. Kat pleads for peace to no avail. Then the great John declares himself for Rob Stark, king in the north, and the rest follow. So, Brian Pavlak, what do you want to talk about? Shall we talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
Well, I thought I'd just bring up one thing I also study is castles. I just want to make a few comments about the castle.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah.
I can never get enough castle stuff. So, lay it on me.
Well, it's unusual to have a three-walled keep. There are hardly any three-walled keeps that I've been able to find.
Yeah, I noted that. That's a little odd, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, most common is best design, particularly in the early castles, were just round keeps, and standard was square keeps. And then, like, Chateau Gaillard had a pentagram-type keep. Three ones, and I think it's like he tries to describe it as sort of like making a point, pointing up river, so the rivers sort of flow around it, is sort of the impression I get.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and there's one famous castle, Ludwigsburg, in the middle of the Rhine River, that looks like a little boat sitting there, and it also has, you know, a little sharp prow, but the rest of the structure is pentagonal, and the main keep is round in that. So that's what I think he was going for. But I just don't see it as a good design.
Yeah, triangular, it's not a great design because so much of the room is lost to you.
To the corners,
right. To the corners, that's right, yeah.
And it doesn't give you, and those corners are so would be so tight in any triangle, at least two of them, that you don't have much control of the view of the other walls. And that's the key problem why they started adding all sorts of turrets and bastions and other castle parts is so you get observational points around all the walls that you needed to.
Mm-hmm.
So as people approach.
Now, this one happens to have a balcony that juts out from one of the walls so that you can see people from far off or something like that.
Well, is, are you referring to the solar they're talking about where
that's right.
Father is? Yeah. So again, you're also a triangular solar. Solars are fairly late development, and they are have to be either high up or well protected because they are more fragile because you want big windows because you do want the view. That's the whole point of a solar is to get the sun shining in and instead of dark, dingy castles.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. What I found more interesting is it also had a water wheel attached. That's highly unusual to have a device that is used to grind grain, a mill, attached as part of a castle. It would often be part of walls and fortifications, but castles not so much, particularly not to the keep.
Well, and this one's built in the middle of a river. I mean, that's a little...
So it makes sense.
Yeah, that's odd, but...
And there's a great description of the Watergate, and of course, the most famous Watergate is in the Tower of London. And just how, you know, they pass into the Watergate. And two, that Caitlin's thinking strategically. I like that nice little detail. She notices the rust and how well it might hold up to battering ram, but you can't really use a battering ram on a boat. So I don't know how you'd use a battering ram against
well,
the water.
You could
gate.
Build a, I guess, if you're going to do like a siege that lasts a month, you could build, I mean, the famously.
You could pound pilings in, I guess.
I mean, famously, the Romans built like a land bridge. To Masada. So, I mean, that took years, but I like that detail because it really does show Kat as she's strategically minded, but she's strategically minded in a way that not necessarily in sort of battlefield tactics, more like relative to siege tactics, because that would be the place of a highborn lady, you know, sort of managing the castle,
right?
While the siege is going on, So that was a nice little detail for sure. Let me read this passage. I thought this was an interesting little note here. "You cannot mean to hold the Joffrey, my lord," Galbert Glover said. "He put your father to death." "That makes him evil," Rob replied. "I do not know that that makes Renly king. Joffrey is still Robert's eldest true-born son, so the throne is rightfully his by all the laws of the realm. Were he to die, and I mean to see that he does, he was a younger brother. Tommen is next in line after Joffrey." "Tommen is no less a Lannister," Sir Mark Piper snapped. "As you say," said Rob, troubled, "yet neither one is a king still. How could it be Lord Renly? He's Robert's younger brother. Bran can't be Lord of Winterfell before me, and Renly can't be king before Stannis." All right, so here we have Rob, and Rob is basically parroting the strict laws of succession, right?
Yes.
And I think he's smart to call out this notion, like, look, the same thing that's kind of giving me power in Winterfell, and not necessarily Bran, who, you know, let's say my younger brother decides he wants to be Lord of Winterfell. The same thing that's giving me power in Winterfell is giving the son of Robert Baratheon power in King's Landing. And these laws have to be rigid because if we sort of let them crumble, then folks like me will lose their power, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then two pages later, they all declare him King of the North.
Yes.
King of the North, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, like, how should we be thinking about laws of succession here? Is it about the narrative relative to, you know, birth order, or is it really about who's got the bigger army?
Well, that is the challenge of living in a civilized society. Civilization provides laws, and the laws often support those in power over those who pay for all those who are in power, the peasants. Yeah. And those in power, too, often want things to go smoothly. And the peasants often just want to be left alone sure. and live lives in decent comfort and not be burned and destroyed and killed and murdered, which is going on here. You know, just describes how right. Gregor Clegane had just been ravaging the Riverlands.
Yes.
So laws, you know, cut both ways. And ultimately, I'm being a pessimist here, it does come down to power, but it's not always the power of the sword. I always keep coming back to the riddle of the swordsman, right? You remember?
Yeah, remind us, but because I think it's really important.
Yes, because you have a swordsman standing there, and a king says to him, "Obey me, and I'll give you power." And a cleric is standing there, and he says, "Obey me, and I'll give you salvation." And the merchant is standing there, "Obey me, and I'll give you wealth." Uh-huh. And the riddle is, whom does the swordsman obey?
Right.
And it's a rhetorical question because the swordsman has the choice.
Right.
And any individual swordsman, like I said, you can obey the Pope or you can obey the king, or you're going to try to dodge all of it and live your own life. People are always making those kind of decisions. So people have choices, do have choices.
Yeah, yeah.
And the choices are then enforced, though, often by power. And power is a combination, and I love those three, a combination of wealth and force and belief.
Mm-hmm.
You believe something is right, you're going to do it. You can't do it unless you can afford to do it. And if you're going to afford to do it, it's often going to have to be violent.
Right.
That's the way the world works.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially the Game of Thrones world,
right.
Which is a softer version of our world. Now, today we like to talk about the rule of law. Well, just look at current events. I mean, oh my gosh, look at what's going on in Sri Lanka. A family took over the government. That's often what's missing from these news reports in Sri Lanka, that a family took over the government. They appointed themselves to almost all the important political offices, changed the laws so that they could, changed the laws that all these benefits went to them, and screwed it up royal, and everybody's suffering, and the people then decide to take power, and they manage to frighten the royals, or in this case, presidents, but the place is still chaos, and the brother-in-law of the previous president, who's been appointed in charge by his brother-in-law, is telling the army to do whatever they can to crush all this uprising.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a Game of Thrones situation.
Absolutely.
Or it's a medieval rebellion situation.
Absolutely.
And again, what will succeed is who has the will to stick it out and the power to keep fighting and the luck of the battle. And you can say the same that's going on in Ukraine, and the same that's going on with our own politics on a milder, perhaps less violent level.
Right.
But this is how the world works.
Well, okay. So I think, how would you respond to this? All right, I'll make a statement. So it is power rules, and then the question is, what happens to be more powerful, the narrative or the will to the throne? And I think in this case, the narrative for Renly is quite weak, right? I think that Rob calls that out. The narrative, Renly, you can't tell the story that gives him a right to the throne.
Well, it's only because Rob is attending to the strict letter of the law.
But
and really,
okay, yeah. Go ahead. I'll let you finish. Go ahead.
But what do laws really mean by those who can change them at will? This is what the idea that law, the best law, in a medieval attitude is the best law is old law.
Oh, okay.
Nowadays, right. It's the best law is new law. But back then, the best law was old law. So people would try to find old laws, and they have often, of course, forged documents to create laws. Now, let me also just back it to the larger issue. Who decides who becomes king? In Game of Thrones, oh, look, we have a bunch of laws. But really, who united the Seven Kingdoms?
It's someone who upset the apple cart and conquered all of them, right? So Aegon...
Using the secret weapon of dragons.
Yeah, using magic, basically.
If he haven't... A magical creature. So if he hadn't had this magical creature, dragon, he would have gotten maybe nowhere. Maybe would have won. We don't know.
Yeah, yeah. He's not even making magic. Marriage alliances because he's marrying his own sisters.
Right? And spoiler, of course, for the next volume, how does Renly lose? Magic again.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a fair fight. You know, Stannis uses magic against him, surprises him with magic.
Yeah.
And how does Stannis lose? Well, that's mostly his choices because his magic fails him. He doesn't have good enough magic and good enough decisions and good enough character.
Yeah, the magic is fickle, right? So
the magic is fickle, but also depending on some poor choices he makes and his own personality. Like you said, Renly's case is weak. Renly's a charmer.
He is. That's his strength. Okay, so he could be successful. He might have been successful.
Now, Rob, at the beginning, is complete unknown. Nobody knows Rob Stark. And that the scene happens in this chapter where his barons, his bannermen, in the new terminology of the Game of Thrones, his bannermen, shout him out to be king. They do that because they come to know him in a few weeks of battle.
Okay.
And they've seen him tested in battle, tested his leadership, and they approve of what they've seen.
Okay. I'm going to nuance this a little bit. Okay. So I'm really happy that you mentioned the medieval view of law. The best law is the old law, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that this is a very interesting play by great John Umber. So what does he say? He says, look, I don't care about any of these Southern people, right? I don't care. Basically, what we did was we married the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who undermined the dragons and unseated the dragons? Well, it was Ned Stark and company. Right. So it was a Northman and a Baratheon and a few others. And they basically unseated the last dragon.
Mm-hmm.
So they undermined that little bit of narrative and it started to crumble.
Yes.
And then 30 years later, you can say, well, you know, we married the dragons. We never married these Baratheons who used to be our allies. And so let's choose a different narrative that allows me to put this boy on the throne, Rob Stark. And the better narrative is the older narrative. It's the kings of winter. Let's return to that rule of law. And so what ends up happening, now I was going to say before this conversation, I was going to say, you're just picking which narrative you like. You know, if you thought the best person to be king was a Targaryen, you'd appeal to Aegon. If you thought the best king would be the next Baratheon brother, you'd appeal to Robert, you know, Robert's overthrow. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that you believe that the next king, the next person who should be king is the Stark. And so you've taken this separatist or secessionist narrative, which, and I'm glad that you said this, which we now know is the older. And if the older is better, you can kind of see why this narrative has the strongest sway, right?
Right. And that's exactly what's going on. Is people are always choosing their narratives. You know, like coming back to that Pope King question. Mm-hmm. You know, you're gonna side with the Pope because he's in charge of eternal salvation, holds the keys of the kingdom, and you're gonna side with the King because, well, he's in charge of this world and he affects your taxes and your safety and all that stuff. Or the personality. This King is a crap. I'm not gonna follow him. Or this Pope is a jerk. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do something else. People are always choosing their narratives, and that is this root narrative. Underlying Game of Thrones, of course, there used to be seven kingdoms. Now, before that, there were the previous people that got invaded and killed off. So let's not even talk about them.
Yeah.
But when the men came from the east, they created these seven kingdoms, which the kingdom of the north is always the sort of rebellious and independent. But again, they were forced by the dragons to do it. But of course, there are no more dragons until, of course, the next chapter, right. We get our dragons again.
Yeah.
So spoiler alert, next week we get the dragons.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
This King of the North thing and secessionist, you know, that's a common problem throughout history. Let me draw some historical comparison going on here.
Okay.
So when the Carolingian Empire fell, Charles the Great creates this big empire. Uh-huh. And it fell because it's attacked by Vikings and Saracens and Magyars or Hungarians. And they go rampaging throughout Europe, and political power is unable to hold together, and things fall apart. And instead of one empire, we wind up with the Kingdom of the East Franks and the Kingdom of the West Franks, and this Lotharingian territory in the middle that Germany and France fight over for the next 1,000 years. That's the history of Europe. Germany and France fighting over the leftover middle kingdom of Charlemagne for 1,000 years until after World War II, they finally decide to make nice and create the European Union. But again, how do you decide to create any sort of government? And the people were faced back then was how do we create stability? And that's why we have the rise of castles and knights. Knights in their castles created the defensive capability and the offensive capability to fight off the Vikings, the Saracens, and the Magyars. And the kings had sort of fallen in by the wayside because they were not able to organize on a national level because things were too chaotic. And some kings were just jerks and lazy. You know, I love the name like Charles the Fat or Charles the Bald or you know all these kings. But they're not able to do anything much. And then just to focus on the East Franks, my specialty, what becomes the Holy Roman Empire, the Charlemagne's line dies out. So we have a line, at end of a royal dynasty, and who becomes in charge? And they start to fight over it. And different families, like in Game of Thrones, start fighting over who's going to be in charge. And they also try to say, well, who's going to be the next king? Are we going to base it on dynasty or through family connections and primogeniture, the most popular form with the eldest born son, and then ticking down afterwards through brothers and then or sons or whatever? Or are we going to create an elected kingship, which eventually happens in the Holy Roman Empire? So they begin electing their kings, but it goes back to old law. The old barbarians, Germans, elected their kings. Old law is good. And so what happens is one family takes over and they don't like that. So the king, Conrad, decides when he dies not to give the kingdom to his son, but convinces his son to hand it over to his worst enemy, Henry. And the son goes along with it, the barons go along with it, and Henry becomes king. Now, Henry also has to bash a few heads to make sure everybody obeys him. But then it's his turn to get close to dying. And he says, well, I'm going to turn it over to my son. I have a good son called Otto. He's great. Otto's going to become king. And so he writes in his will and everybody says, okay, Otto becomes king. But Otto's younger brother, Henry, doesn't like that. Right. And Henry rises in rebellion.
Interesting. Okay.
And Henry's excuse. Henry
sounds a lot like Renly, by the way.
Exactly. Yes, it does. And I don't know if there is any real knowledge on George Martin's thought. He's not really strong in the Holy Roman Empire sense. But Henry Jr.'s main claim to fame, he was born under the purple. He was born when his father, Henry, was king. And he gets his father's Henry name. Mm. So he must obviously be the next in line. And he and Otto have to go at it for years until Henry finally gives up and Otto gives him Bavaria, and Henry's happy and fighting in Bavaria until he dies of a semi-natural death.
Hmm.
So things back then were all up in the air, and that's sort of what they are here. You know, the Targaryens came in and shook everything up. And have you read the book he wrote, Blood, that they're basing the new miniseries
Fire and
on?
Blood. I have, but I want to ask you a quick question about this king who decided to give his kingdom over to his bitter rival.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Conrad. What was the political game
in
that?
Well, again, we can't know everybody's minds perfectly, of course, because our sources are so limited, but historians have often said he realized that if it went to his own son, that rival is probably going to rise up again and cause trouble. So why not give him the problem? Say, and maybe he knew his own son was incompetent.
Oh. Right?
Sometimes fathers know their sons are incompetent.
So this might have been a choice between, do I give my son the kingdom or do I give my son peace?
Or do you give the realm peace?
Uh-huh. Sure.
Right? Because that's, you know, like in the TV version, right? You know, this chapter is almost non-existent. You know, I spent 5 minutes on that debate. But there's a great scene, or maybe it was this chapter before. No, it must be the chapter before. It's episode before, episode 9.
Yeah.
You know, Varys, when he's talking to Ned in the dungeon, he's talking about the realm, for the peace of the realm. If you bring in your enemies close and make them responsible for it, that might be a good idea. And I think that's what most historians say, that why Conrad didn't. He knew Henry would rebel again. Henry had the power, the authority, the respect. Why let his son do this in a very fragile situation where their family haven't held it for very long, right? The Carolingians used to have it. Now they're this new family and nobody really trusts them. So then dynasties take time to build up that legacy of fixedness.
Right.
It just doesn't happen. That's what you're saying about the Baratheons. They didn't have any fixedness, you know. No, yeah, the Baratheon took charge because he was able to kick the Targaryens' asses and they lost and they died out, except for these few fringe refugees who will amount to nothing except they get dragons, or she gets dragons.
Right.
But because her brother is worthless too. And what an idiot.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I like about The Game of Thrones, it shows people changing their minds and their attitudes can based on their own self-interests and their own experiences. And that's why I said they vote for Rob to be king and go back to this tradition because it's their old law, their old memories. They've always been struggling to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob has shown himself a leader. And they don't know Renly. They know Stannis is a jerk.
They're deciding to do this.
Yes.
Because it's like they can smell weakness.
Yes.
It's like, oh, there's like, now we have the boy king on the throne. We know that he does not have a strong claim. You know, there's Stannis, who has a stronger claim to the throne. There's Renly, who's now claiming to be king.
Well, Stannis' stronger claim is only again if you believe the bastardy. And again, of course, that's also a delicate issue. I think we talked about it last time. You know, that the proof of the bastardy is very vague. A lot of people aren't buying into that. But Joffrey's cruelty is being proven more every
day. Well, in this chapter, we don't even see... I don't think Rob doesn't know, because he's still considering, you know, Tommen to be king Joffrey dies. Either Rob doesn't know about this, or he doesn't believe it. I'm not sure which it is.
Well, I don't think Ned got the information out, did he?
He did. I mean, he got a letter to Stannis, but I don't think.
Oh, Stannis to Stannis, right? And that's why Stannis is convinced. Yeah. So Stannis is convinced. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So I don't think Stannis has sent the letter out yet. Right. So interesting. I always kind of, in my mind, I always got that a little confused. Like, when does Rob actually find out? But of course, that's not till the next book.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to note about this, which I thought was a nice little literary bookend. Kat walks into the Godswood and sees Rob, who's now the Lord of Winterfell, and he's praying under the Godswood, right? He's praying under the heart tree. And this, of course, is the second to last chapter of this book. Mm-hmm. The second chapter of this book, you know, if we don't count the prologue, the second chapter is a Kat chapter, and she begins it by walking into the Godswood and seeing Ned praying under the heart tree. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she has to deliver the message to Ned that Jon Arryn's dead. And here we have Rob, you know, dealing with the aftermath of Ned's death. In the Godswood. And I just thought that, you know, it's a very clear mirror of these two situations.
And note how they change it in the TV version. She goes to the Godwoods to find Rob, and what is he doing? He's hacking at a tree with his sword, ruining his sword. He's angry. He's furious. He has no control.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the book too, you know, I thought it was very interesting how Martin makes Catelyn a voice for peace as a mother, as a woman, uh-huh. not wanting more death and bloodshed.
Right.
Or the TV version, she says, we're going to get our daughters back and then we'll kill them all.
Yeah.
And she's totally silent during the King of the North meeting. So, you know, they clearly changed the characters. I think you're right. That's a beautiful moment because, and you believe in things, you know, belief, as I said, the belief, the religion plays an important part in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the old religion of the old gods, which the North still pushes. And then you've got the seven gods of the South mm-hmm. and, you know, other gods.
Yeah, and even
countries.
Great John calls it out. He's like, even their gods are wrong, right? So
yes.
I do think that there's something about the show that tried to remove certain elements of magic and certain elements of religion.
Quite often, yes.
And often sort of saved those, you know. In other words, it's not something that sort of permeates the world of the show. But it is brought in every now and again if it will move the plot, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're like, let's make this more of a political thriller. And
yeah, it's more Machiavellian, you know, using mm-hmm. pure power politics and self-interest to make decisions
rather than
issues of faith and belief, which is stronger in the books.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was a nice little bookend there. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. And of course, you know, you've got Kat, who, you know, when she's introduced, she does not feel fully at home in the North,
right?
You know, she's been there for 17 years or 14 years or whatever it is, but she's never quite felt at home in the Godswood. This is going to be Ned's world in a way that it will never be her world.
Mm-hmm.
And now finally, it took the entire book for her to get there, but she's finally returned to the home of her birth. And so she ought to feel more at home. You know, she should feel more like a fish in the river, you know, perfectly at home. And yet all of this stuff is happening in her life. And just to call it out, it's her relationship with all of the men that should be the most important to her that are troubled. Mm-hmm. Her father's dying. Her son, who is too young to be king, is being named king. And, you know, she doesn't even know if he's kissed a girl yet.
Yes.
He's killed Ned on the battlefield. Surely he must have kissed a girl. But she doesn't know. That's how young he is. And then, mm-hmm. of course, her husband's dead. And so she's really a woman without a home at this point, because she's no longer sort of a creature of Riverrun, and all of her identity is wrapped up in these men.
Right, and that's why I think she's Martin gives her this role of the mother who is asking for peace. And that's where you get a very sexist exchange where, you know, Great John says, "You are a woman, my lady. Women do not understand these things. You are the gentle sex," says Lord Carstark. "A man has a need for vengeance." And she has this beautiful response, you know, "Give me Cersei Lannister, Lord Carstark. Uh-huh. We'll see how gentle a woman can be." But I understand futility. And she's being prophetic here. So the novel has a prophetic. This war is futile. It is not going to wind up the way any of them want, except when we get the deus ex machina of the dragon.
So I was wondering, you know, she has this interesting exchange with her dying father in this chapter. And you kind of get the sense that, you know, he's not on the milk of the poppy, but I wonder how
he is. He talks about him being on.
Yeah. I mean, they say that he's kind of sobered up for this meeting, but you wonder, like, geez, like how much has this dulled this guy's wits? You know, he's still got these old concerns and these old grievances he's nursing. You know, he's wondering why Lys is not there. And then he's like really upset that his younger brother, who's probably in his 50s, never married. You know, he's never going to let it go. Yeah. Anyway, I just thought that it was just such a real moment of a real, you know, older man with power. When everything else is gone, what he's got left are these old grievances that he's just going to hold on to.
And his grievances are also about family. So I said this importance of dynasty and marriage and continuance. That's what royal or aristocratic noble families do, is, you know, they keep track of these genealogies. They arrange these marriages carefully. And they want the children. Now, I was intrigued, you know, why doesn't the Blackfish marry?
Yeah, I was wondering that too.
He's a character I would have loved to have seen more in the books. You know, George R. R. Martin sort of brings him in briefly and leaves him again. And he seemed like such a great, interesting character.
Yeah, I was wondering, is he sort of like an older, confirmed bachelor?
Yeah, you know, confirmed that kind of thing. Bachelor. Right.
So I was wondering that too. Or what? Maybe he's a playboy. Maybe he's like, I'm not going to be tied to any one woman. I mean, that's also possible too, right?
Although he mostly just talks about warfare. You know, I think he's mostly fond of war.
Or could it be that...
great warrior.
Yeah, could it be that he does have a woman, but he refuses to marry her because she's the wrong sort of person to marry, you know?
And in this chapter too, he's too old at this point. You know, he says, "I'm just too old."
I do like that, you know, Hoster Tully is basically like, it was my right to choose his bride for him.
Yes.
And I almost wonder, like, is this just a thing between brothers? Like, no, I'm not gonna give you the satisfaction of choosing my bride. You know, is it something as petty as that?
Well, choosing brides and spouses is the key to many of the dynamics in these stories. You know, that Cersei lines up with Robert Baratheon. Oh my God, what a terrible marriage. And the whole foundational fight before that with Rhaegar leading to Robert's rebellion. And or of course, Rob's downfall is, of course, also related to marriage. You know, he's already made the promise to marry the Walder Frey girl. And we know that's not going to happen. And that leads to the Red Wedding. So family and marriages is the peaceful aspect of what they focus on. But when things don't wind up peaceful, they resort to violence again. And so it's all intertwined, you know, and that's again, this duality of, you know, power and love. Because ideally, dynasties would be based on love. But they're often not.
It really is hard to find a marriage that was conceived in love.
A lot of bad marriages.
That didn't end very badly in these books. You know, you think of like, you know, how much Ned and Kat love each other. And, you know, there's a certain distance between them. But you do get the sense that they have affection for each other. But this was not the original arranged marriage. you know, Ned kind of stepped in at the last minute. It's not like they fell in love and before they got married. And then, of course, you mentioned Rob, and we could mention Tyrion's first wife. You know, anytime anyone marries for love in these books, it usually ends really badly.
Yeah, it's the price of love, I guess.
Now, here's my question to you, Brian. So, all right, so that's the world that Martin has created in these books. In these books, we rarely meet a commoner and kind of see what the life of the commoner is like.
Mm-hmm.
If we do meet a commoner, it's usually because they're connected to the aristocracy in some way. So, all right, so it's problematic for these lords and ladies to marry for love. Would it have been the same for the common folk? I know that arranged marriages would have been sort of the norm, but it would be less problematic if the farmer's daughter married the blacksmith's daughter just because they happened to get romantic one night. So I guess, is this a problem for commoners in the same way it was for lords and ladies?
Yeah, it was. Now, again, particularly looking at the different groups in society, you know, at the bottom are the serfs. And the right of a serf to marry, depending on the local law and custom, was controlled by his lord.
Mm-hmm.
Lords had vast interests in whom serfs would marry, and particularly that a serf might marry out of the manor and go to someone else's manor, that loses the lord his labor. So lords would control serfs' marriage. Now, the right of the first knight is an imaginary thing. It never really happened. But lords...
Just to fill in the blanks here, this was sort of a Braveheart...
And I hated that so much because you didn't need it.
Yeah, the idea here is that the Lord can have sex with any woman on her wedding night. Yeah. So the guy can basically have sex with any woman in the kingdom when she's, you know, marrying.
And what got me mad about that. Braveheart is you didn't need the right of the first knight, which is bogus. Just talk about rape. I mean, he basically raped Braveheart's wife, and vengeance for rape is a good enough motive. You don't need that whole rigmarole about right of the first knight, which was bogus. That's why I got Eggman gave the film. And then it was just far too long. But the same with merchant families, marriages, because families owned their businesses. The business was their family and the family was their business. They're also careful about who their children are marrying, because you don't want them to lose business opportunities or business alliances or supply chains and things like that. So people obsessed about marriages. And another thing I keep mentioning is, as you have referred to, until modern times, most marriages were arranged by the parents and the family. People did not choose. Now, a good family is going to take into account a love match that perhaps is developed, but also if it's not in their interest, they'll stop it as best they can. But that's also why, again, that I mentioned that word rape. The word rape is also used quite often in the Middle Ages and in chivalric stories, not to refer to a man forcing himself on a woman for sex, but for a knight to kidnap a lady, carry her off, and wed her against their family desires.
Mm.
And that's what many stories are about, is knights kidnapping women.
So they would
women.
Use the word rape of something along the lines of what Rhaegar did with Lyanna.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
And of course, that was, as we learn later, a love match, right? They were in love with each other.
So when Robert accuses Rhaegar of rape, that could be what he's talking about.
Or he's using it in the harsher term because he refused to recognize that, right? Because he didn't like that relationship. And neither did any of the families. So it gets turned into this
tale. And it wasn't Lyanna's right to choose her own lover.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
So I think that I didn't know that. And it does make more sense of the narrative that's told about them, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a classic chivalric tale of...
Interesting. I think that most readers of this book are thinking of rape in terms of, you know, the physicality of the act, right?
Right.
So that's fascinating. It's really a question of who has the right to choose whose marriage match. And Hoster seems to be very upset that the Blackfish never went for the red wine girl. And he's sort of holding on to this grievance, you know, long after she's married someone else and she has three kids by someone else.
Yeah.
Right. But that's, you know, that seems to be the thing that he's holding on to after all these years.
Yeah. Although you also recognize, too, that he's senile at this point. So he's, and that's what senile people do. Their senility often focuses on some minor issue that they blow out of proportion in the present when it is long past. And that's, you know, to me, too, it's this description that is most, you know, he's described as being a sort of husky man in his youth and then a portly man. And now he's just a saggy shell of himself.
Yeah, yeah. Are his assets? I mean, if you think about his assets as the Lord of Riverrun, right? So he has, you know, he's got this land, and that's strategic. And then the question is, so that's never going to, it's never going to increase unless you're, you know, going to take someone else's land.
Right.
But one way that you can gain more power in this world is you could use the people around you as assets. And I'm guessing that the Blackfish is a pretty powerful asset.
No, absolutely. That's why.
Right. So he could easily make a really strong alliance with the Red Wines if his brother will go along with this marriage.
Yeah.
So what the Blackfish has done by sort of exiling himself to the Erie is he's stolen away one of Hoster Tully's most valuable assets.
Right. And that's how you play families. You marry your daughters, and the worthless ones you push into the church. Until situation changes and they become valuable again.
Did we see people pulling their daughters out of the nunnery?
And their sons, the most famous example, Cesare Borgia, the idol or the interesting guy who Machiavelli admires, you know, the military genius who almost unites Italy. Cesare was originally considered the less valuable son and was pushed into the clergy. He was a cardinal of the church. And when his father, Papa Alexander says, well, I need you to be my military commander and all this. So stop the church stuff and I'll make you the Duke of Valentino and go to war, Cesare. He's just the most famous example of people pulled out of the church when they needed to be. Another example, famous example is Alfred the Great. Alfred the Great had all sorts of brothers who were above him. Well, they got knocked off by the Vikings. And so it came down to little Alfred. And of course, he turned out to be both a military genius and a cultural stalwart and helped create England. Those things happen too. Your family is your stock, your valuables,
it's the pieces on the chessboard, right?
And you only have the land, you only have covered the chessboard with your pieces, right? You own the chessboard with what your pieces do. Your family protects your land, protects your valuables.
And it's not a fair fight. It's not like the other guy has the same pieces on the chessboard. So you have to make the most of the pieces that you
right.
have.
Right. They don't come to, you know, chess starts two equal sides. Both have the same odds, but you're born into a world where the odds are not necessarily with you. They could be against you. And, you know, the great heroes are the ones who work against the odds to overcome their difficulties. And in a sense, that's what some of these characters in Game of Thrones are trying to do, overcome their odds. Like Jon Snow, you know, a bastard, although he's technically more important than he realizes, rises to this position of power. Or Brandon, you know, starts out healthy but winds up broken and still manages to see that. But of course, that's also magic involved, which, you know, is a whole game changer in a fantasy book that is different from reality. Like, and that's the main reason Renly loses, is magic is used against him. I think he would have stood a good chance without the magic.
And I almost did wonder at this point in the book, and maybe you can give your opinion on this too, but there was this moment toward the end of the chapter where I was thinking, that's the right play. Go throw in your lot with Renly. Mm. There, you have five of the seven kingdoms.
Right.
You know, going against the Lannisters. All you have to do, kind of dispense with this crappy line of succession narrative, which you're going to dispense with anyway.
Yes.
You know, that's the right play, Rob. You know, go meet up with Renly, unite your forces, and that is the, you know, that's the I think that's the most judicious play you could make at this point.
I think it's a good strategic play, except again for that problem of magic, because Stannis is so determined to win, right? He resorts to dark magic,
right.
And that changes the whole game. And that's again what history does and what the book does. It surprises you with twists and turns of people making surprise decisions and surprise deaths or surprise mistakes. You know, the luck is
so all right. So from Rob's perspective, put yourself in Rob's shoes. You don't know about the magic any more than Renly does.
Right.
What's the right play here? Because I'm suggesting go team up with Renly.
I think the right play would be, if I were Rob, is to declare myself king of the North and dare anyone to come get me.
Oh, and just retreat to the North. Right.
Right. Rob's problem is he wants vengeance and decides to attack the South. And of course the whole marriage issues and finding allies, but if he'd stayed in the North, he never would have had the Red Wedding. And again, it's a lot. Again, one of the problems with the Game of Thrones books, of course, is how vast Westeros is. You know, to sustain an army going all the way to the North in real life is a huge logistical problem. But you also have, but they also don't know, get another magic issue. We have the you know, beyond the wall, the problem's developing there. So again, but nobody knows that,
Nobody's
taking that seriously.
And yet. No one knows that there's going to be dragons in the next chapter, right?
Right. So that changed. But if a non-magical, pure political perspective, I would, if I were Rob, these guys are behind me. We'd kick anybody's asses who comes up north. Let's just do
you
that.
Hold the twins.
And shift a few forces here or there to support our allies. Yeah. And again, maybe stay out of the, because Renly and Stannis, they're going to go at it tong and nails. So we just stay out of that too. Let them fight it out and see who's left standing. That would be my play.
And then, of course, you've got the, you know, you see if they'll trade Jaime Lannister for Sansa Stark. And And that,
well,
yeah, that, then everyone
that gets messed up too. You know, just, nothing goes right.
Right. Well, all right. I'm just going to call it a few introductions here. So, Edmure Tully, we meet for the first time. We also meet a few other lords, including Tytos Blackwood. We meet Hoster Tully, and I don't think that we ever see him again. So, we're going to call him also a departure from the narrative. We don't learn about his death till later, though. We already noted a few show versus book differences, right? You know, instead of Rob praying under the heart tree, you've got him hacking up a tree and ruining his sword. You know, that all of that business. And you have a much shorter council of lords that declares Rob king in the North. So those are a few differences. I don't think she ever has that final conversations with her father in the show. I think she learns of his father's death before she can have that final meeting. I'll have to go double check that to make sure. But I think that's how it plays out. Anything else that you noticed about this chapter that you thought was interesting?
I like the brief mention of Maege Mormont. So again, a female lord with her spiked mace.
Yes. Yeah. Female warrior.
As often churchmen who went into battle and as prince bishops, they often used maces and clubs rather than swords because technically they're not supposed to shed blood. The most famous example of this is in the Bayeux Tapestry.
Oh my goodness. I had no idea about
Odo,
this.
Odo, the brother of William of Normandy, he's a cleric, he's a bishop, and he's riding into battle wielding a club as they're invading England.
So he's a man of the cloth, right?
Odo, yeah.
Odo, and there's some rule about men of the cloth, they shouldn't Shed blood?
Shed blood. So you don't have a sword with cuts. You just have a
bludgeon.
Mace, a bludgeon, yeah. Like a mace, a club. Looks like a little baseball bat in the biotapestry. That, of course, will just cause bruising and bleeding is all internal. Uh-huh. So they're not technically shedding blood.
Now, why?
That was one excuse
all
they
right.
used.
No, this is good. This is fascinating. Okay, so if... Is there like... Is this sort of like a... an off-the-books rule, or if it's just common sense, or is there actually a sort of a rule of polity that's...
There is a rule.
Okay.
And that's one of the problem with having these prince bishops is, you know, they're politicians, and a politician in the Middle Ages has to go to war.
Interesting.
So there was a huge effort constantly to try to get rid of them, but they were strong and powerful enough, especially in the Holy Roman Empire, to continue throughout the Middle Ages. And again, like,
you know, this is actually funny to me because I'm thinking of like Disney's Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't Friar Tuck, like, he doesn't actually have a blade, but he uses like other things to bonk people on the head.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's even in Errol Flynn's Robin Hood. Same with Friar Tuck in that, too.
Interesting. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So clubs and maces.
Mm-hmm. So here they're showing her as a woman also with a sword, which is perhaps too phallic in its metaphysical sense for her to use, and says she's using, you know, spiked mace.
Interesting.
So I thought that was a cute little detail.
Very interesting.
And of course, she's... She dies and then is replaced by her charming daughter, who's, you know, a great character in the TV show.
Right. Okay. Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Mm-hmm.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Trip, I was hoping we could talk a little House of the Dragon, but also a little bit of the new Middle Earth spinoff.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I should know the name of this project.
Rings of Power.
Thank you. That's why we had you on, because you knew the title of the show.
No, now you say it, and we'll pretend you just thought of it. Hey, Anthony, what's that new show called? Like, you know, Amazon's doing it?
Mm-hmm. I think it's called Things of Power.
Things?
Yeah.
It's a precious thing. It's precious.
I want to talk about this because, and let me just throw an idea at you and see how you respond to this.
Okay, tell me.
I think inevitably people will want to compare these two shows as if they have sort of genre similarity. Mm-hmm. I don't think that these should be considered the same genre at all. I feel like Tolkien was writing mythology in service to children's literature, or children's literature in service to mythology, more likely. I think mythology is an afterthought in Martin's world. Martin's writing adult political fiction that happens to have fantasy elements. The mythology is sort of like way down his list of concerns. So even though they kind of loosely fall under fantasy lit, I really think that we need to draw a distinction between these two things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely think they're different. The other day I was talking with a literature professor that's part of like debating whether or not Tolkien defines fantasy for modernity and all this kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. I just realized that you used a lot of words that I'm guessing English professors now are like triggered. They're like, oh no, we're having this debate.
My apologies to all of the English professors out there.
Yeah, I know, because you bring them to the yard, the podcast yard. But I do think you're right, like that there's really different questions driving both series. And at least for me, like I've been a long time fan of Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, that whole mytho-poetic universe of excitement. Mm-hmm. And when I started Game of Thrones and thought, oh, this is kind of like Lord of the Rings, I just was disappointed. It just didn't have that in it. And then sure. I think you're right. Like when you realize there are swords and dragons and some magic things and all that kind of stuff, then they're similar in the sense of the action sequences. But the contrasts, I think, are really, really important. Switching your brain, if you come into it like I did as a Tolkien fan, that this is not like a telling of a fantasy world that has this deep mythological structure that helps you look at the kind of flattened metaphysics of modernity, resisting mechanism and all this kind of thing. That's not what Game of Thrones is doing. Knowing what the goal of a story really impacts being able to enjoy it and appreciate it and then attend to the right kind of things.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like Rings of Power is one of these things where, well, I'll just come clean, all right? This is going to be my confessional.
So you have a religion background. You're going to be my priest for the next 5 minutes.
Says the guy that teaches future ministers professionally. All right, go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And named your kids after characters in the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I have a lot of worry about Rings of Power in a way that I don't really have about House of the Dragon. And the reason is that I feel like I have a lot more invested in Tolkien.
Yeah.
I feel like I've got a longer history with Tolkien. I feel like Tolkien's kind of followed me from, you know, the time I was 9 years old until now. I mean, at different stages of my life, I've turned to this mythology for different reasons. I feel like if this is done poorly, Rings of Power, I'll just turn it off. I'll turn it off episode one, and I'll walk away, and I'll think, well, that didn't happen. Like, I have still never seen the Hobbit trilogy. because I watched the first 5 minutes of the show, and I thought, nope, not for me. I don't need my favorite book of all time butchered on screen. I will walk away.
I feel like Game of Thrones fans, if that's their favorite book, it probably felt similar during the last season of the TV show.
I'm sure, yeah, and I think that that's probably, I'm probably being as ungenerous as some of the worst Game of Thrones fans.
But see, you have this double situation here. One, kind of like falling in love with like literature that brings you into a whole new world, but then it gives you back mm-hmm. your world in a different way. Like one where, like, at the very heart of it, like pity can become the linchpin that opens up awakenings of possibility, and, you know, like whatever you're like the mm-hmm. what seizes you about Tolkien and, mm-hmm. and coming of age that there is a genuine struggle at the heart of the human to do good when it costs you something, mm-hmm. and that the most powerful community one can have are good friends. Like that, you don't read Game of Thrones and go, hey, look at the Lannisters. This is what family's for, you know. So I think that there's like the beautiful possibilities of a world of meaning, purpose, and value, despite its ugliness and brokenness. Tolkien is trying to give us such a rich account of this world. You think mm-hmm. it might be possible in yours. And in Game of Thrones, you get this kind of like honesty about just how fucked up human beings are. And
Well, it's also about falling in love with these human beings, right?
Yeah.
It's like for some reason, I'm in love with the journey of Jaime Lannister, who is as messed up a protagonist as you will meet in literature, right? I think with Game of Thrones, I kind of come to it for the characters. Like, I think that a lot of people think of Martin's work as sort of a plot-driven story. I really think it's a character-driven story. So every now and again, I'll like realize, like, okay, Martin's actually pretty good at this, you know, like it's a really beautifully constructed sentence, or I'm kind of curious about the world building behind this. With Tolkien, I feel like there's a little part of my life, a little part of my soul that has been partitioned off and kept pure for Tolkien. With Game of Thrones, I'm like, yeah, let's see how this relates to everything else. And who cares if I didn't like this chapter? And I'll move on. And if House of the Dragon's not perfect, I'll be like, yeah, but it's pretty good television. I don't feel nearly as generous about Rings of Power.
No, what happens if characters you named your children after mm-hmm. are in Rings mm-hmm. of Power?
What if they stink?
You know that totally sets up for cosplay moments, right?
Yeah,
but like you're going to win Father of the Year.
Yeah, but what if these characters are played by, like, horrible actors? I mean, I just feel like there's a lot on the line. There's a lot on the line.
There is. But, see, I mean, I love Tolkien, and I love the books. I think the Lord of the Rings movies are wonderful. Mm-hmm. There are things they change to it that, you know, I would prefer an extra hour in the first movie to hang out and mm-hmm. and just have some fun in the forest. And then, anyway, go see Tom Bombadil. And anyway, but I think I'm going to watch it and celebrate it.
I want to too, man. I want to be with you. I want
them to spend all the money on it so sure. that then they say Amazon. See, Jeff Bezos, horrible person. Like, you know, I, as a good, committed Christian socialist, I think he should be taxed into oblivion mm-hmm. and not have privatizing space. And he's put all sorts of businesses out. Amazon's horrible. Addicted to them, personally. I mean, I'm not getting rid of Amazon Prime. But I used to have to keep my Amazon Prime just to admit my depravity as a person. Good. Now I keep it on behalf of Tolkien. On behalf of 20th century's most compelling literature to give us back a world that has been raked over by scientific reductive materialism, re-enchanting the possibilities of friendship and narratives and journeys. And then I'm like, okay, Bezos, look, let's make a deal. We'll tax all the other billionaires into oblivion. We'll let you keep the money as long as we get good Lord of the Rings TV. And eventually you do all of Silmarillion through The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, episode by episode, like 60 episodes over like 6 years. It'd be the greatest achievement any one percenter's ever done. That, I think, see, that's my hope. See, I'm leaning on the positive side. That's what I'm going to do.
You're really good at talking. You're really good at talking. I feel like I was nearly as good as talking. You've had a lot of practice, I think.
You know, I'm like I'm almost at 1,500 podcast episodes. I probably can't keep up with Bald Move because they pop them out like five or six a week.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk about House of the Dragon. Are you excited about House of the Dragon?
I am because. As someone who does lean on the positive side of fan engagement, I feel like House of the Dragon is it's got a lot of money behind it and dragons. So you got that.
Sure.
Two, it's based on books that are done. That's a perk. Also, the way the book was constructed, that kind of like history style and multiple voices in it, means that the creators get to give an authoritative account of the story as long as they follow the outline because mushrooms tells it this way, you get it this way, and all that kind of thing. I feel like if you're going to have a follow-up to Game of Thrones, knowing how the other one ended, it's got all the materials you need to make it GOT, but the flexibility that it can be turned into good TV. So I'm optimistic. But see, I'm optimistic about Tolkien on screen as well, so And I've watched all three Hobbit movies, extended editions, multiple times. But that could be a teenage son.
I've got a hot take on House of the Dragon. Are you ready for this?
Ooh, a hot take. Oh, hold on. Let me put on my fire retardant suit.
Yeah, good.
All right, I'm ready.
I almost hope that this show does not have the success that the previous show had. And I'll tell you why. My feeling is that because Game of Thrones became such the international phenomenon that sort of drew all kinds of eyeballs, that made it sort of event television, that it became so successful that, like, you know, it was sort of like being advertised on other shows and being parodied. And I would see it at an MLB baseball game. You know, I would see it everywhere. I almost feel like that cultural weight made them think, okay, we've got to pull out all the stops for season 8. We need to make these last 4 episodes, you know, 90 minutes long and make these giant battles. You know, we want to bring spectacle to the screen because we want to pay this off to all these folks that are showing up for event television. I feel like they were a victim of their own success. And I feel like if House of the Dragon is just sort of like a moderate success, then it could be that the showrunners decide, let's just finish this story in the way that we began it and not try to turn it into something that we weren't trying to make in the first place. That's my hot take.
Oh, so you want it successful enough that they keep making stuff, but not so successful that they make it for a universal audience.
They change the pacing, they change the way that they tell the story, they change the, you know, I just feel like season 8 was actually a pretty amazing television. You know, the numbers never went down, but I feel like the showrunners felt like they needed to sort of one up themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they needed to like push all their chips in at the end, and it didn't really work in terms of storytelling. It didn't work for sort of the hardcore fans. I want House of the Dragon to draw interest from the nerds like me and you, and I want them to continue to appeal to the nerds like me and you throughout the entire series. I don't want there to be watch parties, in other words.
Oh, well, I'm going to guess at least week one there'll be watch parties.
Okay. But maybe it'll be
then
like
everyone's going to realize that Rings of Power is so much better, so they're just going to... They're going to be like, wow, we don't need any more watch parties. Anthony told us he doesn't want this to be too popular.
I'm going to watch I'm going to watch House of the Dragon with both eyes open. I'll probably watch each episode a few times. I'm going to watch Rings of Power with one eye closed, like looking through the slits in my fingers and, you know, a little bit nervous. That's how I'm going to approach these two shows.
Kind of like when it's the lectionary text is one of your favorite like gospel passages, and then you turn on the TV and it's stuck on some channel. There's like a preacher on it and you're like, oh, they're about to butcher this. This is one of the best Jesus high quality.
Well, that's even
parables.
Worse. I cannot watch anything Bible related on any screen. I'm out from the beginning.
The more you like it, the less supportive you are of it going.
I can't turn off my brain. No. Like I just did this Mary Magdalene project. You know, we're sort of like surveying Mary Magdalene and all these different films, and every single one is like, man, this is horrible. This is a nightmare. This is. I mean, even the good stuff. You know, even the interesting like Martin Scorsese stuff is like. Mm-hmm. Why is Harvey Keitel wearing a Little Orphan Annie wig? This is odd. This is very odd.